So then we have a report from our State Board liaison, and I think you also have a PowerPoint presentation to give.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, they sent it, but I think I've got a flash drive.
And while we're setting up a PowerPoint, what I will do after Ms. Darumo's presentation is item 14 is public forum. So if any of you have speaker cards, you know, maybe you can already start filling them out and passing the cards. Thank you. And maybe we need to adjust the lighting slightly so we get better contrast for the folks in the back. Perfect, thank you. Yep, this is excellent.
Well, great, thank you. Good morning. Good to see you all. My name is Dee Diodano, and I am one of the board members for the state board, and thought that I would spend some time with you today. I am in the area mainly due to a meeting that I had yesterday with some county officials talking about drought issues. And so since I was going to be in the area, Steve Moore suggested that as luck would have it, you were having a meeting at the same time, thought that I could spend some time with you to talk about drought issues. I've been serving along with Felicia Marcus on the Governor's Drought Task Force for several years now, and it has been quite the roller coaster ride. And luckily, it looks like we're moving out of the drought, but the main focus of this presentation is really that we can't ever say that it's over, because we are just in that cycle of drought, flood. There's a few average type years in between, but the wide swings is what we see in California. And so it's really important that we are constantly planning for the next drought cycle. Okay, so the Drought Task Force has been focusing on a number of key areas that have impacted or that have possibly affected this area. So, in particular, emergency drinking water assistance, that's been provided quite a bit, in particular in the San Joaquin Valley, but there are pockets throughout the state that have been able to participate in some of those grant dollars. Fire response, and in this region, of course, the two big events, the Ray Fire in August, that took over 32,000 acres, and the Big Sur Fire over 50. So significant events that, of course, are now continuing to see the harm with respect to erosion issues with these storms. And then system operations. And really what that's talking about is the role that the state has in the management of the systems, the water management systems in the state. So for this area in particular, that's been gets served in part by the State Water Project, this area has been pretty critical to those operations. So the state and federal projects have water permits through the State Water Board, and the governor's emergency declaration provided us with authority to make adjustments temporarily to those permits as needed. The idea being that we have conditions on the state and federal project. These are the two main projects that are servicing over two-thirds of the state of California, and the export pumps. And if those entities were to follow their conditions, that are included in their permits during this extreme drought period, then we would have run out of water very quickly. And so the idea was, let's see where we can make some adjustments so that the water can be used wisely for all beneficial uses. Mainly, the concern was that we wanted to maintain water quality in the Delta. If we ended up with saltwater intrusion, higher salts, then we wouldn't be able to pump anything out of the Delta, which would have impacted this area in particular. And then emergency conservation regulations. These are the urban water conservation regulations that our board adopted. And that little timeline there at the bottom shows how we have had to adjust those regulations as the drought intensified. And so we started off in 2014 with reporting requirements. A requirement to all urban water suppliers in the state of California to provide information to our board on the amount of water that was used, gallons per capita per day, and also reporting to us on their conservation measures. That was during the period of time where we had, and we were operating under the governor's directive that all Californians should conserve, reduce their use by 20%. And we saw as we were collecting that information that people weren't conserving up to 20%. And so as the drought intensified in 2014, we ended up adopting specific prohibitions, kind of the things that you would say, well, of course, you know, don't hose off your sidewalk, that sort of thing. Not getting real detailed at the state level, but expecting local suppliers to get detailed on what exactly needed to be done, whether that was, you know, a ban on no more watering than 2 days a week, etc. Then in 2015, that was when we had to get tough. So in 2015, we imposed the 25% conservation mandate, and that was geared at 25% on average statewide, not for any one water supplier. What we did instead was look at the history of water conservation in the various water districts, and then we tailored a mandate to each individual district. So, example here, City of Santa Cruz had already done quite a bit, so it would be a little onerous for us to say, okay, good work, now you get to do 25% more. So their standard was much lower. I don't have the chart before me, but, you know, I think it was somewhere around 8-10%. And then in other communities, the community where I live, I'm in the San Joaquin Valley, we hadn't done as much and really should have. And so our conservation standard was much higher. You know, I think it was around 35%. So overall, though, on average for the state of California, we were to hit 25%. And in fact, we did hit that target. And then in 2016, we ended up making some adjustments because we saw that that standard didn't quite work in certain areas of the state, especially where they had high temperatures. And so we've, you know, really been learning through this process. And I think by the time we finish it, in the next drought, we'll be able to dust something off and get going right away without having to go through, you know, a lot of adjustments. And then in 2016, we made an adjustment because of some of the precipitation that we saw. And we asked water suppliers to come up with their own standard based upon a stress test. So they needed to certify. They could either continue to follow our standard or they could put together their own standard if they could certify that they had water supplies for the next 3 years. If they didn't, then they had to impose their own standard. And this chart, I just had our staff pull out a few key areas for the region. And so let's just take Marina Coast Water District. But they didn't self-certify. Let's see here. Okay. Yeah, so these districts that continue to operate under a conservation standard are operating under the state-mandated standard. And then for those that have zero, it doesn't mean that they don't have a conservation standard. It just means that they have certified that they have the supplies, and then they have their own standards that they've imposed upon themselves. And if you look at the cumulative savings here, from June 2015 to November, we're looking at this region really, you know, stepping up over a period of time here. So Cal Water in Salinas, 26%, Marina Coast, 32%, Santa Barbara, 36%. And then in the green, this is the average residential gallons per capita per day, and that's between January to November in 2013. So let's take Carpinteria as an example. They were 103 gallons per capita per day in 2013, and the average between January and November of 2016 was 83. So you can see how this region really did step up. And then down there at the bottom, that bears noting as well, the statewide average, 132 gallons per capita per day, and reduced down to 102. And of course, you know, we're looking at all communities, some that, you know, would be using more water, maybe depending on the climate and that sort of thing. Yes.
Sorry to ask you, I see the asterisk did not self-certify. What does that mean?
So what that means is that they did not take that option for the stress test. They continued to operate under our standards. So they had, you know, there were two paths. Okay, and then I think you have access to this PowerPoint. I'm not going to go through it, but you know, if you want to take a look at your individual communities, you've got access to this to look at it. Okay, and then obviously we've seen some changing conditions here, and so I wanted to go through. These are charts that we get at every board meeting. We have a drought update. We look at things statewide and look at the U.S. drought monitor. That's the thing that a lot of us have been seeing on the news with, you know, the burnt orange, the big blob that seems to be resting over Southern California, that's turned into, at this point, you know, several smaller areas. So San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, further south in the southern part of the state. And so this, I'm going to just show you the percent of average. This is just precip. So this was the chart for the 15th of January. And then you see what a difference those storms made just over a one-week period. So I believe that the county at this point, Santa Barbara County, is 166% of average for precip. So again, just kind of making that comparison. Big change. But we can't just look at precip, obviously, right? So let's take a look at snowpack. And the reason that snowpack is important to this region is, or any region that's getting served by the State Water Project. And as I understand it, the use on the State Water Project really is intended to be a supplemental supply. So you can't rely on it all the time. But as we look at the lake levels of Kachuma, that's an important source for Kachuma. And so it's important to be tracking what's going on in Northern California. And this just pulls out, we have an index that we look at, Northern, Central, and Southern, and this is just pulling out right here, that graph in the middle, just to give you an idea of, you know, how quickly things can change. So right there in the on the graph, the blue line that's climbing up, that's where we are right now, really way above average, which is terrific. If you look at percent normal, for this date, we're at 193% of normal, so tremendous snowpack. And if everything just stopped, the date that we look at for snowpack to come up with a determination of how we're doing is April 1. So even if we were to look at the April 1 date, we're 104% on average. So that's just terrific. But if we look at, okay, this is where it gets kind of hard to see this chart here, but okay, the brown line, I can't really, okay, so 2015, You see how it started off pretty good in 2015, and then we ended up with just horrible temperatures, and we just lost control of that snowpack. So with climate change, we can't look at these graphs as we have in the past. So even though it looks like we're in terrific shape, we really don't know what the next few months are going to look like. And so statewide drought conditions, definitely much better. 2% of the state in exceptional drought, which is the highest amount, and then 24% of the state still in extreme drought. And this is already outdated. I saw something on the news, and it's shrinking, most definitely shrinking. But here's why we can't just count on this. This drought monitor only considers the current conditions. It doesn't consider things that are really important to planning, and that is reservoir levels and groundwater, so our long-term storage. So the storage is doing great in most of the state, but the reservoir here in this area, Pachuma, this is outdated. It's showing 9% of capacity, and at this point 12%, but still really way down. And in fact, the area, as many of you know, had to get funding in order to lower the intake in Lake Kachuma so that they could get access to the water that was at the lower levels. And the state did participate in that funding, providing a $1.5 million grant. Okay, and so here's some of the local reservoirs and where they are in surface storage. So Lake Nacimiento, I'm talking about, this is the one in Monterey County at 61%. Lake San Antonio, 18, Kachuma, 11, I think at this point it's 12. So here's a couple of other, key areas. And then Gibraltar at 43%. It's, just really varies depending on, and Gibraltar, as I understand from the discussion with the county yesterday, the difference there is, just the differences in the watershed, in the local watershed. And then I appreciate your comments, Chair, on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and some of the work that you're doing on with development of the local GSAs. And, this is really something that the whole state is going to have to grapple with. The Sustainable Groundwater Management Act was adopted in 2014, and local entities are busy at work. And I'm just really pleased to see that at first it seemed that there were some local entities that were really fighting this, like, why is the state coming in here telling us what to do? And then most localities have quickly shifted to, let's focus on what we need to do to keep the state out. So the state board holds that role as a backstop. So if the deadlines aren't met, like if a local basin doesn't have a GSA developed, we would step in. If they have a GSA but they put together a plan and it doesn't meet the sustainability test as outlined under Department of Water Resource guidelines, then we would step in, and we get the same toolbox that the locals have. So we would have the ability to impose fees and limit extractions, and of course, once local entities read through the law and saw that, they realized it would be better to have those decisions be made locally, A, to keep the state out, but B, because they know their basins better than we do, and that just makes a lot more sense. So what next? I mean, now we've seen that we're seeing flooding throughout many regions of the state. The governor issued a proclamation on an emergency on flood conditions. 50 counties have some type of flooding going on in their area. And so it's really easy for us to forget what it was like a few years ago. And we've seen what really is this illogical cycle of, it's raining, we're fine, and then it stops raining, and which is sort of apathetic over a period of time. The drought starts, and it's sort of this slowly emerging crisis. It's not like a tornado that hits you. It sort of strikes you slowly. It seems, gee, it hasn't rained in a while. You start to hear reports about drought, become a little more aware, and then concern, and then panic, and then that tremendous reaction. And you could see that the state really came together. But what can we do so that we don't end up with this illogical cycle, and we have this constant awareness that that's just the way of life in California? And so really, how do we break that reactive cycle? Education, you know, it's just exciting no matter where you go. People talk about the drought, as we have adopted and made changes to our conservation standard, lots of good dialogue. You know, should the state have done that? Should they have stopped it all? Or no, this is the right time for the state to stop and for the locals to come in and really take over from there. And so good dialogue. Let's continue that education, though. And then the Water Action Plan, this is something that the administration came out with several years ago, and it's a full plan on how should we be looking at our water future. And there's a lot of good stuff in there on this, how to break this cycle so that we can engage in better planning. So always being prepared for flood or drought, which is really opposite sides of the same coin. So to be prepared for drought means better utilizing those storm flows when we do have them. So pick up, use that opportunity, and really be planning for both at any time, providing for greater resiliency through drought or flood. And then the long-term conservation strategy in terms of those local orders now, the local stress test, we're going to be updating that order in a few weeks, and so it's possible that we'll make some adjustments, but really whatever we do maintain, certainly will include collection of data and developing sort of a bridge for the next step, and that is long-term efficiency standards that we are working on developing in conjunction with the Department of Water Resources. So lots of good dialogue going on right now with the urban water suppliers, the NGO communities, about really what should that average gallons per capita per day look like? Should we have those huge variations throughout the state of California? How do we account for climate and communities, and et cetera? And so really spending a lot of time on that. For the long term, and luckily not in an emergency setting where we have to act quickly on the fly. And then, of course, in the Water Action Plan, looking at all types of supplies, the days are over where we could say that there's any one thing that will get us out of these drought situations. You know, oftentimes you'll go to communities and they'll say, well, if we just had more dams, we need more storage, and if we had more storage, we'd be fine. And then you go to other communities and they'll say, conservation. If the state would just conserve permanently, we wouldn't have these problems. Or we need desal facilities up and down the coast. And really, it's not any one strategy, it's all of the above. We really need to be looking at surface groundwater, storm flows, water recycling, which I don't know why I don't have that on the list, desal, greater use of our groundwater basins, and of course also looking at ecosystems and how to better protect our ecosystems so that we're not being so reactive to the needs of endangered species.
All right.
So thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions. This has been 24/7, you know, over the last couple of years. It's nice to finally get a little bit of a breather. Yes.
Thanks, Dee Dee. Couple of questions for you. On the three years that was chosen for the stress test?
Yes.
I'm kind of curious how that number was decided upon. I could see throughout the state that different regions would have different levels of water supply available to them. Certainly in Southern California, you know, our drought conditions last longer than that.
Right.
And I'm just wondering why, at least for the South a period of time of 5 or 6 years wasn't chosen?
So I think in large part we were getting there because we were, that stress test was adopted at a time of the other chart about that brown line.
Right.
You know, things were looking pretty good. And so we were at a place where this has been quite interesting, how to keep the pressure on and at the same time not confuse the public on message. So when we adopted that stress test, it was raining like crazy, it was snowing, and we needed to figure out a way, you know, to balance keeping the pressure on. First of all, the main thing we wanted was to continue the collection of the data. We had a lot of water suppliers that were telling us, hey, back off, you know, we don't have the emergency anymore. And so 3 years, there was nothing magic about it. And again, this long-term strategy for efficient standards, you know, gallons per capita per day, but what should that standard be statewide or regionally, is being developed in a much better form, and that is, you know, giving us the luxury to have a dialogue about what should we be looking at. We didn't have that luxury. We had to move quickly, and I think it was just something that, you know, we pulled together that we thought was fair in light of the situation that we had a lot of water suppliers telling us, you know, let's cut it off. And now it's interesting. No matter what we do, we're going to have a challenge with messaging. So if we do anything, we will hear from certain communities saying, you really should ease up entirely, because otherwise our communities are not going to pay attention to you in the future when you say that we all need to act. And then, of course, other regions that are saying, hey, keep the pressure on. We're really getting a lot of progress. But it's interesting, even though we just had that stress test in 2016 and a lot of suppliers certified, we have 3 years of supply and we're fine and we don't have to impose a conservation standard. Statewide, we're still at about 19%. So, you know, we're really, I think the public has heard the message and they are truly making conservation a way of life.
So going forward, let's assume that this winter turns out to be just exemplary, mm-hmm. and most of our reservoirs are plus 85% full, and we've got some good snowpack. Is there a plan going forward that we still have some type of requirement for our water agencies that they have to be able to declare, certify that they've got a certain amount of water supply available for a number of years going forward?
Okay, good question. So the Department of Water Resources requires urban water management plans, and those are currently under review for, you know, additional requirements, perhaps along the lines of, you know, the stress test. But that's also the form in which these long-term efficiency standards are being developed. So this gallons per capita per day that we're seeing here on average, what we are likely to see is an actual requirement. And that would probably be, I think, by region. I'm really not sure, but the state board would have a place, much like SIDMA, we would be the backstop in the event that urban water and suppliers don't meet they go over that cap.
Okay. My other question has to do with storage and the interplay between, and this is going forward, the interplay between SIDMA and then maybe what the governor's office wants the state water board to do about groundwater levels. So, I mean, the governor, I mean, could say, you know, yeah, or the drought is over for rainfall, snowpack, surface water supply, but as to groundwater levels, we're
right.
still in a deficit. And therefore, I want the state water board to continue to do X, and I don't want to wait for SIDMA to catch up and put their controls in place, which is going to take 20 years. I'm just curious whether there's any thought or discussion about having the State Water Board kind of, you know, attempt to do more about replenishing groundwater levels
absolutely
sooner
yep
than waiting for SGMA to kick in.
Absolutely. So we've got Prop 1 dollars. We've got temporary permits for capturing stormwater that the governor issued an executive order, and that's been a little slow going. Easier said than done, because capturing stormwater still requires a permit. And so because we want to make sure that an entity that's capturing stormwater to recharge a groundwater basin isn't impacting another legal user of water. So we have to go through that analysis. I think what we heard from the governor is do it, but do it fast. We want to be able to capture those flows. And then also looking at long-term opportunities. And it's really gets down to individual basins and soil types. And so we're expecting local entities to come to us and ask for help, and then where we can provide the funding. And so those are the opportunities that we're really encouraging local communities to jumpstart and not wait for SGMA.
Okay. Just my last question is a quicker answer, I believe, than the others would be. Has any basin opted out to form their own GSA and has just decided to have the State Water Board take over?
Oh, no.
No.
No. I don't think that would be desirous. Yeah. To put it mildly. Yeah.
Well, I heard in up in San Luis Obispo County at one point, there was a discussion for the Paso Basin that maybe they were going to let the state just come in and do and take over.
I have heard those comments, but I haven't heard that is a real likelihood in any area. Not that I know all areas, but yeah, I don't think so. And we've got a really good staff that's been going out meeting Eric Ekdahl, going out meeting with communities, and really the message is, even though we're thought of as, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, really we are wanting to ensure the communities are successful. I mean, just think of it, us running, right, managing a basin. I think if we did that once, then the rest of the state would see that's not what we want for our community. So we may have to, but it's not something that we're excited about.
Thank you.
Mayor Delgado. Thank you, Dee Dee, for being here today. It's always one of my favorite parts of our meetings when we hear from Stephen Moore, and it's great to hear from you, too. Following up on something Jeff said about what the State Board will be doing in the short term, I guess, if things keep looking rosy as far as rainfall, snowpack, does the State Board advocate checklists of actions that individuals and industries can take to conserve water so that there's communication between the State Board and industries and communities that very simply lay out best management practices? You know, we always hear about 50 things you can do to save the planet, you know, shorter showers and all that. But in the recent drought, I haven't seen too many of those lists, except too many of those items listed, except for what was required, you know, 2 days a week or
yeah
driveways, that kind of thing. But especially when it comes to industries who sometimes use 85-90% of the water that is used, I don't see those lists coming through the regional board. So I wonder, do they exist?
Yeah. Okay. Good question. So as far as best management practices, this is not an area that we have, again, during this emergency, moving and moving quickly and wanting to be very cognizant of not impacting the economy of the state, because the drought itself was already impacting the economy of the state. And so we really focused on, for the most part, we were focusing on urban water use, residential, and outdoor irrigation, because in our view, this was one area that was, you know, discretionary, and that if you stopped watering the lawn, it really wasn't going to have a big impact on the economy. And if we look at even that, there were some unintended consequences. Mr. Young and I were talking last night about the trees, you know. So some, in many areas, people really took a sniff of them and went further, and then even their trees were suffering, which is something that we didn't want to have happen. So they aware of any unintended consequences. And so as far as industrial, we were expecting the local water suppliers to address the industrial piece. And what we did do was, with regard to industrial, was outdoor watering. So if you have, you know, a corporate office with a huge lawn, we were expecting them also to abide by the standard. As far as long-term, this is what the Department of Water Resources is working on. These long-term efficiency standards, you know, starting off with residential. And then I would just say, Save Our Water, there's a public education campaign, and there's lots of information, you know, on that website. But I agree we can always do better, which gets back to, you know, the point that I have, long-term education. Being more aware of what you can do.
So the last minute that you were talking just now, it seemed like you were focusing on, again, the population rather than the industries and the trades. So do you think that the State Board will make any changes in the short term, midterm, out years, to try to communicate with industries, including ag and other industries, similarly as we are communicating with populations?
Well, I can just say on industrial use. So we are expecting change and greater efficiency with respect to industrial use. That's, I feel like it's a little bit outside my area of expertise. I know that the Department of Water Resources is working on that. As far as agricultural, I'm an ag member on the board, so I can speak a little bit to that. And that is, you know, in some areas, you could have a drip system that in fact uses less water. In other areas, drip could end up resulting in more water use than, you know, existing, like, say, a furrow irrigation. And so there, in the ag sector, there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all. But the Secretary of the Department of Food and Agriculture, Carrie Ross, is most definitely on this. They have a grant program. There's also some federal dollars for conservation. But as far as us coming out with an edict that you know, all of agriculture should go on drip, I don't see anything like that happening anytime soon, because you can't have a one-size-fits-all. It really depends upon the crop. It depends upon the soil types. And then there are also issues with, you know, flushing out of salts and other things that I know you all are working on with respect to irrigated agriculture.
Okay. Thank you. I was interested in your address of snowpack, and I realize that I'm ignorant in understanding why it matters in regards to, let's say, reservoir storage, when the snowpack melts. I mean, I know we don't want it to melt all at once and have flooding, because then the flooding isn't necessarily captured in the streams that go into the reservoirs. But aside from flooding, how does the timing of snowpack melt affect, if it does at all, storage, reservoir capacity storage?
Okay, good question. So let's see here. All right, so Shasta and Oroville and Trinity and Folsom. Okay, so those are the main state and federal reservoir projects. And they are capturing right now, as you see, they're capturing that precip. So it's coming down, you know, it's wet. And a third of, and then those reservoirs, the water will be released as there's a demand. Right now, there's really not much of a demand. So there's no releases at this point in time except for flood releases. And many of these reservoirs are at flood stage, so they're having to provide for those releases. Once there's a demand for the water and that water starts to be released, we've got our snowpack that is one-third of our reservoir storage historically. So we've got that entire snowpack, and you can picture what, you know, all these mini reservoirs up and down the Sierra. And as the snowpack melts, which is post-April 1, through the summer, those reservoirs will refill. And so there's an opportunity to release the water and then refill it long past, you know, the period of time that those reservoirs are filling right now. And so the longer that snowpack stays intact, the greater the opportunity to release the water and then prepare for the next season. So if we're seeing that snowpack being released into the late summer, that's after the demand, say for agriculture, after most of the agricultural demand. So now we're getting ready for next year. And if the next season ends up being dry, well, so much the better then with, you know, the ability to utilize that snowpack.
Got it. I should have known that, but it really helped that you explained it. My last question is on Sigma. In our area of Salinas Valley, we have dueling applications for a portion of the Salinas Valley groundwater basin. There's an area called the Monterey Subbasin near some cities, Seaside Marina. Mm-hmm. And Marina Coast Water District initially applied to be the management agency for that subbasin, and the application was accepted, which means I think that it was legal and proper in all ways it needed to be. It met the standards of application. And then subsequent to that, Salinas Valley Groundwater Management Agency applied to that for that same subbasin. So how do dueling applications, how are they handled?
Our staff is trying to work, I don't know on that specific case, but our staff does what it can to intercede through mediation. So we actually have some funding available to provide for, and I think that it's being utilized in the Paso Robles area, where the officials from DWR and our staff can participate in those discussions to kind of help resolve those issues. Ultimately, we could get it, and we could be the ones to resolve it. But that would be, you know, not the preferred approach. But I believe we would have the authority to be able to resolve those disputes and set up a GSA. I'm not positive, though. But right now, the approach is that funding is available to provide for, mediation-type assistance.
This is my last little ask. Do you know if there's much, are there many examples of overlapping applications throughout the state, or are they somewhat rare at this point?
Well, I'm not aware of applications. That's the first I've heard of an actual application where it's overlapping, but what I have heard of frequently is local discussions where, you know, these things are still evolving.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf, and thank you, Mr. Diamo, for your presentation. I'm just a little curious in terms of Sigma, and I haven't followed it closely. I understand that in terms of the regulations, you know, the devil's in the details. What's a sustainability plan? Well, mm-hmm. What is sustainability? That DWR is the lead agency putting those regulations together, and that the state board has a kind of a dual responsibility to work with them on it. I was talking actually with board member Gray, who's absent today, yesterday about the Cuyama Basin, which is drawing, I think she was saying, 30,000 year old water now. And we were just trying to picture how they could even come up with a sustainability plan without dramatically changing the water use in the basin. Where are we on defining what a sustainability plan is and what the concept of sustainability plan is? Is it to, in the case of basins that have been in overdraft for years, is it to stop it at wherever it is now? Is it to, is there a restorative concept in there? What can you tell me?
So maybe Dr. Wolf can help me out. I know he's much more involved, but I believe that the baseline was the year of the adoption, 2014, I believe. And so I don't think we're expecting to go back to a perfect situation. It's unrealistic in most areas, but maybe you want to add to that, Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, initially the deadline, which is going to be end of May, is to the formation of the groundwater sustainability agencies. So once the agency formed, and you can do it with GPA, joint prior agreement, that basically starts then the development of a plan. And the big issue, how are you going to fund it? Because it's going to have to be funded within the basins. So then comes in Prop 218 vote, where then people will vote to agree to assess themselves, which we're still working on the definition. Is it a fee or a tax? And by the way, that's in the courts right now, because the difference between a fee and a tax is the difference between two-third majority or a simple majority. And that's what took place in Paso Robles, by the way, because the two-third got resoundingly rejected. So once you establish the funding mechanism to fund the agencies, then you develop the plan, and ultimately you have up to, if you're not a critical basin, you have up to 20 years to bring your basin in sustainability. So, you know, there is a lot of steps to go through, and, you know, my experience is where a lot of the trepidations come from is for cost, and who's going to pay for it? And the big questions are, is it one vote per parcel, or is it one vote per acre? And then you have a disconnect between folks who are on 200 acres and say, hey, you mean I get only one vote, versus someone who has, you know, a half an acre small property. So that's where a lot of the challenges come in. But to support your comment about DWR, for example, Tuesday in San Luis Obispo County, and we actually offered our conference room of Regional Water Board to host this meeting, all of the six basins in San Luis Obispo County are going to meet, and all of the potential GSA all in one room, and DWR is going to be facilitating the meeting to discuss one where everyone is a little update on each basin, but very importantly, looking at how we can have better synergies in cost. Because, for example, in San Luis Obispo County, when the County Department of Water Resource presented to each basin a potential budget, it was $1 million. But here it is, $1 billion per year for 5 years, times six. So we're looking at, okay, how can we pool efforts? How can we, for example, when we have to have groundwater basin characterization studies, because, you know, right now, not all basins have been very well characterized, so you need to have some hydrogeology to further define, you know, do you have overlap between sub-basins and leakage from one basin to another? So that costs studies. So it's, okay, how can we maybe have consultants package and bundle three different basin studies and get a better, you know, better price? So that, you know, not to divert from the rest of your question, I wanted to clarify.
Well, to restate the question simply, if you have a basin that's in critical overdraft, what is the target of sustainability? Is it that that you hit sustainability when your recharging at least as much as you're withdrawing? Is that the definite? Is there a definition of sustainability?
Okay. It's to bring the basin back in balance, where hydrologically it's in balance between how much you pump out versus what the recharge is to the, in the basin, with the understanding that, you know, you have modulation from year to year, but that's the bottom line, and you know, you answered your own question.
Yeah, and I just, as you were framing the question earlier, the things are going to change. I mean, it's going to result in significant change. And, you know, really, what does that mean? And what we're seeing is that because some of these basins are in such, you know, serious overdraft, that there are estimates that, you know, we're going to see quite a few acres going out of production. So it will definitely change the landscape in certain areas more so than others. But I personally think that the way it's been structured is the best decisions, I think, are local decisions, especially on something like this, where local communities really understand their basins. But those are tough decisions for local entities to make. We're going to shut you off. I mean, that's a very difficult decision. But as long as you have the state ready to implement its own version of a sustainable plan, that's one way to really keep the pressure on. And that's where I think we can, we were talking about the three-legged stool of, you know, that includes technology and other creative solutions. Each basin is just so different. And so we're hoping that some creative approaches will be emerging, but we're not fooling anybody. This is going to be tough.
Yeah, and in regard to the three-legged stool, what we have adopted in San Luis Obispo County, you know, I suggested part of a mission statement is to distill, you know, some of these multiple points to, you know, three aspects. One is water augmentation, the second is water conservation, and the third is innovation. And I suggest that conservation alone is not going to bring us back to sustainability. So in the water augmentation, particularly in this in the county of San Luis Obispo, it's looking at emphasis on stormwater capturing, for example, in agriculture, and in residential rain barrels, LIDs, low impact development, you know, rain gardens, etc., but also recycling municipal water and using it both for ag use, you know, purple pipes, but also, you know, ultimately for drinking water purpose, and in direct groundwater recharge of recycled water. So that's one of the aspects. In the innovation, and you addressed that, in ag, for example, which is a big water user, you know, there's definitely opportunities. For example, now the latest leading edge technology is moved from above surface drip irrigation to subsurface drip irrigation, and there's a lot of good work being done there. So that's another example. I would say one of the big challenges that we have also is the total unpredictability of the weather, because it's hard to be strategic when you can be totally off on the prediction or projection of weather. If we take the example of last year, all the major scientists, all the big think tanks, NASA, the best smart people in the state predicted last year, 2016, a Godzilla El Nino, which we end up with a El Nada. And millions were spent in erosion control, flood control, protection, etc. 2017, same group projected 2017 to be a La Nina. And here we are, we're actually in the Godzilla El Nino. So I think it's very difficult in a way, you know, it's part of becoming more and more adaptive, is to be agile and being able to move around as we need. And I think everyone is going to have to do that. The other thing I wanted to briefly address is Mayor Delgado, very good point about industries, because, you know, we can look at ag and say, okay, ag, you need to do a better job in what your water usage. I think sometimes the numbers are a bit confused when, you know, we're citing the amount of water used for ag. It also does include environmental benefits. So some of the mandatory discharge and use are for environmental benefits as well as ag use. So sometimes these numbers are lumped and can be confusing to people. But in the industrial sector, I think a lot of good work is being made. I'll give you a specific example is in wineries. Well, wineries right now, if you look at the Wine Institute certification program for wineries that they're developing, one of the module is water quality and water quantity, and it's basically water efficiency to reduce amount of water use. And that's kind of, I think, one of the new paradigm we have to look at is when we drink and we eat, is how much water does it take to produce that? Not only to grow it, but to produce it. Mm-hmm. So brewery is another good example. And you know, where it takes several gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of beer. Now it takes a little less, you know, to produce a gallon of wine. So, you know, I'm not suggesting switch to wine, but it takes one gallon of water. You know, we have bottled water here. It actually takes 1 gallon of water to produce 1 gallon of bottled water. And people say, how can that be? Well, that's the process. You know, it's the sanitation of a bottling facility, etc. So I think, you know, you brought a very good point, Mayor Delgado. That's a whole other aspect that, you know, we need to look at and becoming smarter at it. The city of San Luis Obispo right now is looking at having a prohibition of bottled water for two reasons. One of them is the state dismal recycling program that we have for plastic and glass, etc. You know, where your recycling facilities, I mean, about, I think they're down to 1/3 of what they used to be. But it's also the city is looking at, you know, the amount of water it takes to produce a bottle of water and having public fountains, etc., where you have your own refill station. You know, just like some of you have your little cans and you use the water fountain. So I think all this is good conversation. You know, and your point you made, I think, is very valid in, you know, that big picture. So sorry to get a little bit off the track here, but this is a fascinating topic.
It is, and thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you today, and what I appreciate more than the opportunity for me to provide you with comments is to just have this dialogue. I really got a lot out of it. Thank you so much. Good to see you all.
Thank you for joining us, and we appreciate your presentation. And I assume we're going to post this PowerPoint on our website, so this will be access to every one of you.
Thank you.